Hi, welcome back to At the Devil's Ball, where we try to talk about horror and genre-related subjects in a thoughtful and meaningful fashion. With me, I'm Samuel Numene, and with me, as always, is Nathaniel Johnson.
Hey.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm well.
So we're finally getting around to a little bit of Clive Barker this week with one of my favorite Clive Barker films, although really I only count like four of them anyways, and they're all my favorite Clive Barker films. You know, obviously Hellraiser, Nightbreed, Lord of Illusions, and this week we're doing Candyman.
Yeah.
1992. They call it a slasher movie, but I don't know. It's kind of a gothic love story slash horror slash urban slash
we'll get to that, like, and yeah. I told you before we started recording I'm gonna try not to go off on a rant,
let's do the intro, and then we'll both get the rants out of the way, and then we can actually focus on the film, because I think we both want to kind of talk about that a little. This is kind of like the start of the modern wave of black horror or black themes in media. You know, the first one was the 70s, where they had like blaxploitation, and then the networks, I can't remember which network, like, you know, stopped running like Beverly Hillbillies and Hee-Haw, and started running the Jeffersons and the Good Times and all that. And then the 80s was like just like Reagan, and it was white as all hell. And 91, 92 is where the hip hop scene started to reemerge and kind of take over, I think.
That's true.
And this is one of the early marks in that, even though it's, you know, written by, directed by, half starring, you know, white people. I feel like it's still a pretty valid entry into the genre. How do you feel about that?
I do. I agree. And we'll definitely get to that as well. But yeah, this movie, and I've heard discussion. It's one of the things I want to rant about, is this discussion about whether or not this movie is actually problematic or not. And I think, I don't think it is, mainly because I think people are misreading it. And, and hopefully I want to make sure we stress this, as we've said before, on this show, we're a couple of old white guys,
right?
Please keep that in mind. And if we say something that pisses you off, we'll apologize. We definitely want to be sensitive about this topic, and
we can only speak for ourselves, really. We're not speaking for anyone else. It's just our feelings on the film.
We want to make sure,
please, you know, let us know.
We want to make sure we're making clear that our intention is to just talk about the film, and we're not white people solve racism.
We're not Helen. We're not trying to colonize the subject.
Right. And that's an important aspect of this film, I think.
But before we get into all the nuts and bolts and themes, you have the vital stats you want to?
I do. Okay. So it's obviously, as we mentioned, it's based on The Forbidden by Clive Barker, which I meant to reread for this, but I have not. I know you did.
I've got a couple of thoughts I'll get to on that later, but
So it was the screenplay. It was written by the director, Bernard Rose, a very, very talented director, starring Virginia Madsen and Tony Todd as the titular Candyman. We've got we've got Casey Lemons, Xander Berkeley, Vanessa Williams, and oddly enough, Ted Raimi as Billy the Tough Guy in the beginning of the movie. It's probably the funniest damn thing in the whole film.
You know, when I was watching this with Jed, I realized this was probably around the time that he did his guest spot on Twin Peaks as another kind of, like, you know, metalhead person.
We've got some other, but I wanted to also make sure I called out, in this particular case, the cinematography, the director of photography, Anthony B. Richmond, because this movie is absolutely gorgeous. It is so well directed, it is so well shot, and so well lit. Also the production designer, wanted to call out, Jane Ann Stewart, who's production designer, art direction, David Lazin, because all of that stuff is also just genuinely awesome in this movie. There is just some absolutely stunning artwork happening in this film, predominantly in the form of graffiti, which is no small feat to make that gorgeous. And they did. The
lair or whatever.
Yeah, kind of like that. There's these all of this artwork of obviously you can see this movie before you listen to this podcast, but you know, this wonderful almost like cave painting totemic imagery that happens. It's just extraordinary stuff. So this movie is absolutely just an absolutely gorgeous piece of work.
And the Philip Glass score is very good too. Yes, and I'm not even like really a fan of Philip Glass, but I think the score is perfect for this.
And I think
and for what it's going for.
Bernard Rose even said, I think in one of the commentaries, he kind of
tricked him.
Yeah, didn't tell Philip Glass a horror film. And Philip Glass did the score for this movie, and he didn't know he was scoring a horror film, and he was kind of like, what? But yeah, I forget the name of the piece. If it was Always You, Helen, or
I think something like that.
It's the main title
song, right?
You know, the do 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 do.
Yeah.
I love it. I listen to that on my own. That's on my phone, man.
You nice.
Know, I love it. It's such a great piece of music. So I mean, all of these aspects and elements are all there, and it's all just a beautifully made film.
Yeah, this is definitely a case where like all the parts came together to become more, you know, more than the sum of its parts. It's
I also should call out. Where's the name of the sound? I can't find his name. Sorry, man.
That's okay. You tried to throw me at the opening last week, and I just shit it down my leg. So I think
it was some great sound design on this movie too.
Yes,
especially with the way they use Tony Todd's voice to kind of like boom through. It just overwhelms this movie is really all about overwhelming almost every single sense you have. And and it does an extraordinary job in doing that.
But they do it in a very controlled way where it's not just they're throwing everything at you. Like they know what they're doing.
They know
right.
Yeah. Everybody's at the top of their game with this movie. And it's a really great, really great
thing. Yeah. And everybody's just kind of like almost, you know, completely perfect for the roles. I mean, Tony Todd, you know, we talk about all the time about how nobody will accept another Freddy Krueger, and I have not seen the new Candyman yet, but I'm not ruling it out, but I'm saying like if he's not Candyman, I'm like, you know.
Pretty sure he's in it.
Yeah, I know he's in it, but I think it's just like a little bit, but that's kind of off topic, I guess.
Yeah.
But you had some things you wanted to say before we got to the
First of all, I mean, that brings us up since we're going to bring up the new one. It's Nia DaCosta's film, you assholes.
And Candyman was always political, you stupid motherfuckers.
Yes.
Which they couldn't be more obvious if they tried.
Yeah, and that's something I want to talk about because, all right, I'm going to go there then anyway.
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it. This movie, like a lot of people, like even just today, it is Monday night, late Monday night. Earlier today on Twitter, somebody did a bad take, basically saying, you know, like, I can't believe the new Candyman is woke. You know, it is blaming white people. And people are like, he was literally the ghost of a murdered slave, getting revenge on people who wronged him. Like, have you not seen the original movie? And I actually was looking at that and saying, well, actually, that's not right either.
Right.
He's not the ghost of, this is not a ghost story. This is not a vengeful ghost story.
He was never a slave.
Well, he was. The Daniel Robitaille was, but that's my point, is that and the way I keep coming around to this, and the way I kind of said it to Lori when we were talking about it was, or I was talking at her about it. Because I'm a jerk. I was like, because I saw those bad takes and I kind of mentioned it to Lori because we had just watched the movie the other day, and I said, you know, first of all, yes, this movie was always quote woke. Right. It obviously does have a political statement to make about racial politics in America. It obviously is a point to that, and we'll get to that. But at the same time, the original movie by itself, and we try to do this when we do franchises, when we talk about the original film we did with Alien, for example. We're gonna pretend the sequels don't exist for this conversation.
That's easy for me.
You haven't even seen them.
I haven't seen them.
I have seen them. It's been a while, but I've seen I have seen them. But what's interesting is that now the second movie, when we mm-hmm. get to that, which I think we're doing next week, that's when the whole like ghost of murdered slave thing happens.
Right.
This movie, the way I kind of looked at it was the ghost of Daniel Robitaille does not become Candyman.
Right.
Candyman becomes the ghost of Daniel Robitaille. This is a story about narrative. This is a story about.
I kind of disagree a little bit, but we'll get. Oh, go ahead.
This is a because Candyman is a story made real.
Right.
He's a belief made real. Actually, this movie has more in common with, say, In the Mouth of Madness mm-hmm. or New Nightmare.
Yeah.
Or Scream's New Nightmare than it does with Nightmare on Elm Street. But it's often remembered as sort of being like Nightmare on Elm Street because it's, again, everybody has this idea somehow that he was the ghost of a murdered slave trying to get revenge on his people.
Right.
And they were like, and people were saying it's problematic because why is he taking that wrath out on the people mm-hmm. in Cabrini Green? I'm like, he's not.
Right.
They're his, he calls them himself his congregation. They believe in him.
Mm-hmm.
And what this movie is sort of about is Candyman is a myth made real. This is why we spend 20 minutes at the beginning of this film talking about urban legends.
Right.
And about, Trevor's class being like, you know, him like being, like, it's the alligator in the sewer. Like, everybody thinks this is real. The beginning open movie opens with a college freshman telling her perception of the Candyman myth.
Right.
Which, by the way, everybody also says he gets called five times in the mirror and he appears. That never happens in the movie. It's not a thing. It's actually, he actually starts showing up without a mirror. It's actually this something that a college girl is equating to Bloody Mary. Mm-hmm. And so what I see is that what this movie is, and he pretty much says this multiple times in the film because he waxes poetic about his motivations the whole movie,
yeah.
is he's like, here's the problem. Helen, you came in and you made everybody doubt me.
Right.
So now I have to murder the hell out of you in a very yeah. big operatic way. But not only that, but I have to murder a baby. Because I have to punish my congregation for doubting me. So I have to, first of all, reaffirm.
Well, he didn't murder the baby. I don't think that was ever part of his plan. I think that was part of his, the way he was working her, basically.
Think so? I think he wanted that kid dead.
In the book, the baby is a sacrifice.
Yeah.
In the movie, it's a little less clear, but I mean, it could go either way, really.
Sure. But my point is, I think that.
But everything he's done, including maybe murdering the baby, maybe not, is to, you know, rebuild his legacy and also kind of bring her in it as well.
Well, she needs to be the new victim.
Right.
And that's the point. It's also one of the very smart things this movie does. And I think maybe it slips under the radar is that all of the stuff attributed to Candyman probably didn't happen.
Right.
And that's what I mean by. Daniel Robitaille did not become Candyman. Candyman became Daniel Robitaille is because right. that's who says that. Who tells Helen that? The snooty professor.
Right.
Says this is his background. Then the cleaning ladies say, and that's his condescending way of being like he's just this racial element. Right. You have the cleaning ladies who say, oh, Candyman killed one of our friends, somebody that we know. She may have not have been murdered by Candyman. She may have actually been murdered by a nut job at Cabrini Green, which we do know exist. There are some bad guys.
There. Right. Well, this is a story that's based entirely on, you know, unreliable narrators and unreliable narratives. I mean, it's
exactly. And then you have the story of the kid in the bathroom mm-hmm. who tells her that story. An 8-year-old boy.
Right.
That may not have ever happened.
No.
And that's what I mean is the whole thing is about the way we continue to rotate myths, the way we keep explaining them.
Well, even you know, Candyman himself is, you know, just kind of a hodgepodge in the original book as well as this. You know, he's got the hook for a head, which is, you know, outside of like the, you know, the Barking Doberman story is one of the oldest ones, you know, they can find. They've got the Bloody Mary thing. Much like the politics in this film, the urban legend aspect of this film and the fact that it's about, you know, modern folklore isn't really hidden. So if anybody thinks that it's, you know, not about that, it's kind of like, did you watch the first half of the movie? You know, you dropped out. I can't hear you.
It's what I find interesting about this film is that it's almost become a metafictional variation of itself.
Right.
I feel like there are a lot of people who remember what Candyman's about, and it's not what Candyman's about.
Which is kind of, you know, feeds into, you know, the idea of Candyman as well. in a weird way.
Yeah. And that's what I mean by metafictional representation of itself, where it's like everybody like remembers Candyman being about something. Now, like you said, when we watch the sequel, you'll see why.
Right.
Because the second movie is when it gets more into like he's a ghost, you know.
Yeah.
But this movie by itself.
You know, I think the big mistake this movie has made was in the ending where they show, you know, all the murals of Candyman and Helen, and it's like
I think what we're supposed to read into that though is that that's new. I think because I think what happens at the end of this movie is that Helen, there's something that I was also talking about with Lori, which was the idea that Helen actually becomes two different myths and neither of them are fully true.
Right.
The people of Chicago think Helen is a murderer. That is not true. But the people of Gritty Green think she's a saint. That is also not true.
Yeah.
You know, actually she was just a victim of circumstance who ended up saving a baby.
Not circumstance. Hubris, maybe.
Hubris, maybe.
Ego,
a little bit of one, a little bit of the other, but yes. Yeah.
Because there's
even if it's hubris, she doesn't deserve what happens to her.
No, and nobody deserves to die in a fire outside of a few small examples.
Rather painfully, I might.
Yeah, yeah.
But then my thought process was that mural at the end is supposed to be she's become her myth is overtaking Candyman's. She's won in the sense.
But they showed her as a human woman, like in period gear,
But I think that's supposed to be sainthood clothing. But I don't know. Maybe you're right. I don't know. That's how I
mean, read
this time was I was looking at it being like, right. Oh, painted a mural.
It's not a bad reading, but I know the director of the commentary I just watched like yesterday was, you know, pretty much, you know, of the opinion that Candyman was this person. Obviously, he became more, much more. But there's a lot of that in Clive Barker works to begin with, where, you know, you shed your humanity to become something different.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I agree. It's a very layered metatext in this film that we could probably talk about for about a week straight, I think, and still not get to everything.
Yeah. But that's what I mean that's my two cents on the subject. Cause I was like, is that this movie is actually not, it is about race, but it's not about race. Not here anyway. Maybe the other films are. This movie, though,
it's about race in that, you know, every city has, you know, a part of town you don't go to.
Yeah.
Every city has a population who the city's given up on.
Yes.
Every city has this small sub society of people who are watching out for each other because nobody else is. And that was a lot of the focus of The Forbidden. It was set in Liverpool, where Clive Barker grew up.
Yeah.
It's not a racial thing in that because, you know, he grew up in Liverpool in like the 70s. So, you know, it was probably all working, poor, white people mostly.
Yeah. I remember The Forbidden was more about poverty.
Is this. But I think it was a stroke of brilliance of Bernard Rose to actually, you know, add that element to it because it's not going to play in America, you know, and nobody back in 1992 wanted to watch a British horror movie. That's why they dubbed over like half a Hellraiser, for fuck's sakes, you know.
No, and you're absolutely right. And I agree with you, and yes, that's what I mean is that like this movie is about race, but I don't think it's about capital R race. It's about this movie's more about stories,
right,
and how they take on a life of their own. But also part of the idea, what Bernard Rose is doing here is one thing I caught that I really picked up on this time was Bernadette. They're going to Cabrini Green to do their little research thing.
Right.
Bernadette is like, is loaded up with stuff. And Helen's like, what the hell?
Batman brings less tools out on the night of the town.
What are you doing? And she's like, this area is controlled by the gangs. It's so dangerous out here. We're going to get killed. And when Helen goes through the wall into the next apartment, like Bernadette's like, what if they're packing drugs? And Helen, interestingly enough, looks at her and says like, why would they be packing drugs? Yeah.
This was right at the time in the country where everybody was talking about, you know, crack cocaine epidemics and super predators and, you know, all the other crime bill nonsense that, you know, the Clintons were talking about in the early 90s. Yeah. So it's
like
aware of that.
Yeah. And you mentioned, like, now, you know, gangster rap is right. becoming a thing in America, and everybody's starting to think mm-hmm. that's the African-American experience. They they're all murdering each other.
Well, I just said hip hop, but that's true. That's it was a lot of it.
But my point is that what is Bernadette doing but perpetuating another urban legend?
Yeah.
You know, and Helen, the disbeliever, is disbelieving mm-hmm. that urban legend. She's right. like, they're not packing drugs in there. You know, that's no more real than Candyman is.
Right.
And of course, the only person they really talk to is the woman who outright says, we're not all gangbangers.
Right.
We're not all criminals. I'm just a single mother trying to give my kid the best life I possibly can. Right. I am not a criminal.
And that's what all the crew was struck by when they actually filmed the portions that they filmed in Cabrini Green. They're like, you know, they had the same story. Like, don't go here between this time and that time. You know, there's gangs everywhere, this, that, and they were struck by, you know, that, like, well, actually 99% of these people are just people trying to live their lives. Yeah. In dignity and relative peace.
That's the thing, is there's also no accident that the well-to-do academics in this film are referring to Cabrini Green as if it's a foreign country.
Right.
It is almost like its own tiny little village of
I was struck Canadian. on this watch through about, you know, how much of, like, you know, stuff like The Wicker Man plays into this, or you know, even the old, like, you know, adventure serials, or you know, the Rudyard Kipling stories, where it's like, you know, I'm the big white explorer going here, I don't believe any of these things, you know, and then, you know, they meet with trouble or bad ends.
Yes.
And The Wicker Man is a good parallel to the book, actually a little bit better, because there was a, like I said, they did actually plan to sacrifice the child in that one. Mm-hmm. The community did.
Yes.
So it's a little bit more than this, but I mean, it's still the same thing. Like, you know, you have this outsider coming in thinking that they know everything, thinking that they can't be touched. And then what happens? Well, they get fucking touched, you know?
Yeah. And that's what I always thought of it too, is I remember, because the same thing, like horror noir kind of mentioned, like, you know, the idea of, like, you know, it's problematic because Candyman is attacking his own people, but he's not. He's attacking a white woman.
Right. He's feeding off his own people, and I don't think it's outside of his purview to attack his own people, because I feel like, especially in this one, his main concern is his own continued presence.
Yeah.
He's gone beyond human concerns of life and death, and he just, you know, he just wants to feed and continue to be. So if it takes, you know, attacking quote-unquote his own people, he's going to do it, I think.
Yeah, but I don't think he even has to. I think
he doesn't, because he's kind of an anti-hero to them anyway. So
right, they're already giving him their offerings,
right?
You know, quite literally, like there are offerings in this little shrine they've built to him, where they've painted his picture. They leave a wonderful image of the
king. They tell stories of him.
Stories about him. They're always talking. They're always already respecting him, and when Helen comes in and disrespects it, he now has to get that power back.
Yeah.
But my point was, whenever they said that, and those things, like, why is he attacking people? I'm like, well, I don't think he is.
Right.
I think he appreciates them in his own way.
Yes. He loves them. They're his congregation. I mean,
it's a wonderful line he says. Yeah. You know, without my congregation, I am nothing. But you have damaged my credibility with that congregation.
Right.
And now I need to get it back. I mean, like, and that's one of the things I was thinking about when I was like, well, did he kill Ruthie Jean? Why would he have killed Ruthie Jean? Ruthie Jean wouldn't have called him.
Mm-hmm.
They were afraid of him. Why would they call him? They give him offerings to keep him from hurting them.
Well, Ruthie Jean was the story they told at the beginning, right? The cleaning woman told?
Yeah.
Or was that? Okay. Well, that was somebody her sister knew. It wasn't somebody she knew.
Right.
So it was still once removed. So we don't even actually know if that happened.
What happened? Yeah. What I mean is,
we see the photo of the crime scene, but again, that could be anybody.
Well, we know. Yeah, we've been. Helen meets a guy who claims to be the Candyman,
right?
Who attacks
her. That's a cool ass misdirect. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. which is why I'm like, maybe that never happened. Right. You know, like this, there's a guy who's using it as using, yeah. using the legend as his own cover to right. make himself more scary.
Yeah. To give him straight cred because he's yeah. a drug dealer.
Yeah. Whatever he is, you know, yeah. you know, whatever it is he's doing.
Well, they said he ran the overlords in Community yeah. Breed. So yeah, I mean, you know, obviously not a good guy.
No. No. Well, we know he's not a good guy because he attacked Helen in the bathroom.
You
know?
Right.
But yeah, we know that he could have killed Ruthie Jane. You yep. know, and maybe Bernadette was right. Maybe he was. Maybe they were packing drugs.
Yeah.
In the other apartment, and Ruthie Jane knew about it, so they went and got rid of right. it. But the point is, it doesn't matter because yeah. he contributed to Candyman.
Right.
All of it is attributed to him, which is how he wants it, because it makes the legend all the more powerful. But he may never ever even touch them. And in fact, maybe he didn't. Because right. he's like, well, no, I want you people to worship me. I don't want.
Yeah.
But
he's not. Right. He's not a dumb monster. I mean, he's not going to do the work if he doesn't need to.
All right, point. That's what when I was watching the movie, I was like, the whole point of this is how he said, "Fuck around and find out." To Helen.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Helen. He said, "God damn, I have to work now."
And to be fair, she pursued him first. I mean, yeah. You know, first of all, she's doing this, doing the stories on him. You know, she's working. First of all, can we talk about how much she sucks as building a thesis if she hadn't even read that other guy's, you know, paper on it? Yeah. Now, that guy's a dick, yes. but don't come unprepared.
Yeah.
But she's doing the stories on him, and then she goes, and I don't think this is what got her on the radar, but she goes and does the Candyman thing at the mirror at home, you know, for yeah. a joke.
Mm-hmm.
She shows that she's not taking this seriously, and, you know, in her defense, there's no reason to take this seriously. We all know urban legends are not real.
Mm-hmm.
But then she goes to his house, his hunting grounds,
mm-hmm.
Asking about him, still disbelieving, you know. And when does shit start to go sideways is when she goes through the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
She goes through the hole in the wall, which is where the mirrors were. Yeah. He doesn't come out of the fucking mirror. She's the one with the mirrors, you know.
Right. Yeah, she goes through. Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. Actually, I hadn't even put that together, but you're right. She does go through the mirror in her own way. Yeah, she goes through the hole in the wall the mirror was.
Yep.
And
she does it at home beforehand, but she's not there, so I don't think he noticed until she actually was there.
No. And that's what I mean. Yeah, I think that I think you're right. I think that it's when she goes in there. That's when he's, you know, she comes into his kingdom and starts telling people he's not real. That's when he comes
in.
Which is why I'm like, I don't think the mirror thing is even actually a factor in the movie. It's just remembered as being a factor.
Yeah, I never got the idea that that was his thing per se. And I can't speak for the sequels once again, but I don't know if he's ever did he do that in the sequels?
I think he does. I think the mirror thing is back in the sequels.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, that's what I mean is that the whole thing is sort of the movie has become almost its own urban legend and what
right.
people remember being in the first movie versus what's in the sequel.
But even with that is kind of a smart way to urban legendify, you know, him, because they do have these tunnels going between, you know, old apartments, and they have, you know, these burned out husks that you can just walk, you know, through the mirror one to the other. So I guess they could, if somebody goes in and says, that's Candyman's lair. And, you know, oh, there's a hole between the mirrors. That must be how he gets around. And then it kind of turns into the Bloody Mary thing on top of that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it's but it's just fascinating, yeah. But, yeah, what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, well, in terms of, yeah, again, about Reading Green, I mean, like, that's what I was going with that, where he kind of said they kind of refer to Cabrini Green as being its own little tiny little its own right. village, its own cultural identity.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's literally blocked off.
Right.
Point that out, that it's his own. It's been quarantined. You know, it's got the bridge.
Yeah.
It's got the train. They are blocked. And that happens in most major cities. It's a major part of gentrification.
Right.
Well,
they even talk about it at the beginning, you know, that, and again, it just occurred to me that they were doing a mirror right from the beginning, because she's talking about how her apartment were originally built as, you know, public housing. And then they're like, oh, this is too close to downtown. But we have the same building. So she's living in a mirror of Cabrini Green right from the start.
You're right.
And this is the part where, you know, it annoys me when people tried to say recently that Candyman wasn't woke or Candyman wasn't political, because there is like just this huge block of exposition about how municipalities build their cities to cut off minorities or the poor.
Exactly.
And it's all based in fact. Yeah. It's all, you know, the building she's talking about was actually the case. I looked into it a little bit, meaning I went to Wikipedia for 20 minutes.
Right.
But, you know, the way they built Cabrini Green was all that. You know, it's, you guys don't have to look that hard to see that this is based on real world politics that they're bringing in to make the story more true.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you're left with, you know, just, you know, this guy jumps out of mirrors and scares you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what he becomes. That's what I mean. The whole thing is sort of connecting the idea of, like, he becomes a metaphor for the Cabrini Green people.
Yeah.
But also he becomes a metaphor for the perception of the Cabrini Green people, that, you know, what Bernadette thinks is kind of true, but not all true. Candyman is partially true, but not all true.
Right. I mean, those were dangerous neighborhoods. There's, you know, dangerous neighborhoods here in Cleveland. I'm sure there's plenty in St. Louis.
North St. Louis. Yeah. Don't go. We don't.
Even at the time when they made this, you know, they were people claiming, you know, every day that, you know, oh, Cabrini Green has the highest murder rate in the country. It never did.
No.
It didn't have the highest murder rate even in the city. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm sure you growing up, you used to, you know, I know I had people telling me, oh, don't go past, you know, this point in Cleveland, or, you know, you're gonna be in trouble, or,
well, where I'm from,
stuff like that.
I'm from, Portland, Maine, it's quote worst neighborhood was just another neighborhood. You know, it was, they call it Grant Street, which now to be fair, like, well, yeah, here's one story, is that you know, a friend of mine lived a couple blocks away from Grant Street, and a friend of ours drove into Portland to hang out with us, and we're like, where'd you park? And he went, oh, I think I parked on, like, Grant Street. And we were like, oh man, you might get, and he's like, I'm sure it's fine.
Yeah.
His tires got slashed. You know, so he was like, yeah, I guess you guys were right. Grant Street sucks. But we were like, but that, it's sort of like exactly what's going on with Helen and Bernadette, where it was like, you know, well, what the odds were actually against anything happening to his car.
And there's, you know,
this time.
Right. And there's that thin line between, you know, taking reasonable precautions and, you know, people scaring you.
Yeah. Helen, it's not like Helen completely dismissed it.
No.
It wasn't like, this isn't dangerous. She accepted that it was dangerous, but she was just like, the pepper spray and the packing drugs, all that's nonsense. The best way to deal with it, and actually how she handles the confrontation is actually really smart. Mm-hmm. She says all the right things. She's like, I am a grad student.
Right.
There are important people who know where I am, and they, you know, and I just want to go my way. And this guy is evil enough that he, you know, whacks her upside the head instead of letting her go.
Right.
She doesn't pull out the pepper spray. She doesn't try to defend herself. She actually tries to talk him down.
Yeah.
And which is 9 times out of 10 what you probably want to do in that type of situation. But that's what I mean, is Helen was prepared.
Right. Yeah.
To deal with a bad spot, but she was not thinking in terms of it's a war zone. I got to be ready with a flak vest.
Right. Even though everybody, you know, the whole movie is telling her that.
You need to be wearing a flak vest. Yeah.
Right.
You know, it's a dangerous place. And because she even points out, you know, if Trevor and the other guy, you think they would ever do this? And she's like, no.
No.
Yeah. And I was thinking, well, neither would I.
Right.
Like, and in fact, I mean, that's kind of what I mean, is I'm like, Helen, they probably would have better luck than you and I would.
Right.
Because they would think we're cops.
Yeah.
We would show up dressed conservatively, as you said, they probably were cops.
Well, I did like that they, you know, they're yelling, you know, 5-0 coming
back. Yeah, it's great.
And asking her if she's there for the sweeps and everything. And it's pretty great.
Yeah. And they're like, we're used to this, because every time a crime is committed, the cops come down.
Yeah.
You know, whether or not we had anything to do with it or not, their first instinct is crack down on Cabrini.
Yeah. And that's literally what they did back in, like, the 80s and 90s. There.
Cabrini Green is not there anymore.
No, they've torn it all down.
Mm-hmm.
They had either repealed the law or passed a new law that, you know, undid it.
Yeah.
But there was a point in point of time in, like, I guess Chicago, where, like, if you tore down like one unit of public housing, you had to put another one up. So they did away with that law, and all of a sudden, all the public housing goes away.
It's happening in
your legislature at work.
Yeah, it's happening where in Portland too, where I'm from. Right. That a lot of it's not so much. It's not as racially motivated as as I think Cabrini Green was, but the gentrification happening in Portland is they're driving the working class out of the city.
It's happening everywhere.
In order to make more condos for wealthy people. And a lot of public housing laws have been repealed. And there was not too long ago, there was some racial motivation where there's some people who were immigrants were all brought into Portland, Maine, which was awful, awful for those people because so many Mainers were absolute shitheads to them. I witnessed one of the most awful, like heartbreaking acts of racism I've ever seen. Walking from the grocery store, this guy, these two men from Somalia or wherever they were from, I can't remember. I apologize if I don't want to offend anybody, but I forget where they're from. But African immigrants were walking by, minding their own business, and this guy spit on the ground in front of them, and I stopped dead in my tracks and was like, what? What was that?
Right.
You know, and should I get involved? I remember what really broke my heart was these two men looked at me and just went, "It's okay."
Right.
And I went, but and they saw the look on my face. And
yeah.
"It's okay."
They said, "It's not okay, but if I'm you're like, okay, I guess."
I'm like, "Yeah, but and they were like, "Look, we get it. You know, we're not gonna get worked up about this. So don't you get worked up about this." And I was like, and I wanted to tell them, I'm like, "I'm so sorry." You know, that guy does not speak for everybody. Like, I'm glad you're here, you know, you know, that's good. It's a good thing that you're here.
But there's always, you know, it's sadly in society, there's always this like unspoken hierarchy of, you know, who's accepted and who's not. And it seems more often than not that, even throughout history that, you know, blacks and immigrants are never wanted by these jackasses who, you know, try to speak for the rest of us. And black immigrants, Jesus, you got two strikes against you coming in.
Anyway, it was awful. And I mean, they were having, when I left Maine, that was a problem, was that where they were being housed was becoming a question. Because Portland was trying to get rid of public housing to make room for more condos for New Yorkers.
Of course.
Because they bring in the money. But, you know, and it was just, it's not my state anymore, man. But we got a little bit off topic there. But yeah, I mean, this movie becomes a sad reflection of all of that. And that's why, and so that, to bring kind of back around, is when someone says, you know, "I can't believe they make Candyman woke," I'm like, what fucking movie were you watching?
And speaking to what you said before, that some people have, you know, come out and said that, you know, Candyman is in fact racist. If that's your opinion, I respect your opinion. I think it's very wrong, but I'm more than willing to listen to you. But I feel like intention-wise, I don't think there was an intention to further stereotypes. I think it was just trying to reflect the world of the time and how society viewed these kind of things.
I agree.
And still do. Yeah. I mean, really.
Yeah. Not too much has changed. The only thing that's different is this Cabrini Green's not there anymore.
Yeah. Do you want to go to a lighter topic?
I do.
I can do. Okay.
Yeah.
I think this is the perfect example of how to modernize a Universal monster movie.
Okay.
Extrapolate
on that.
I'm certainly not the first person who said that, you know, Candyman has a gothic feel, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
Or that Candyman is a quasi tragic figure. I say quasi because it depends on whether or not you think that this is 100%, you know, the ghost of this living person, or if he's another entity entirely, which I think he's kind of in the middle. But there's still that, you know, like, oh, my true love has been taken away from me. You know, I've been waiting for ages for you, Helen. But, you know, it's got all this, you know, first of all, the cinematography and the production design being as good as they are, being as beautiful as it is, mm-hmm. Lends itself to that kind of classic Universal Monsters feel, or, you know, the Hammer horror or what have you. But it's set in, you know, a modern setting, and, you know, when it needs to get nasty, it gets fucking nasty.
It does.
I much prefer that kind of thing to, you know, I've come to like the Mummy movies from the Brendan Fraser Mummy movies from the 99 on as their own thing, but I was really kind of like pissed off at it at the time because I didn't think it was a very good adaptation of a classic Universal Monster movie.
Sure.
I accept it as its own thing now, you know.
And that's I love good. The movie.
Yeah,
and actually, it's actually more indicative. I talked about that. It's off topic, but
we
talked about that when I did. Saracen and I did an episode of before I left. Saracen's Horror Menagerie, right. An episode on the Mummy's Hand,
right?
Which is way more in line with the Brendan Fraser stuff. The
original, Mummy.
It doesn't use like anything from the original Mummy other than a couple of names.
No, even the Mummy's different.
Yeah, but that Brendan Fraser movie takes a lot from the Mummy's Hand. And the ensuing sequels. I actually just watched the Universal Mummy movies not too long ago, and they're and when you watch those, you're like, "Holy, that's where the Brendan Fraser Mummy came
from." Right. I was kind of at the time. I was kind of mad at it for not being a Universal movie, and also being a bad Indiana Jones movie. And I was like, I can just watch Indiana Jones if I want to watch Indiana Jones.
But this is actually it's a good Indiana Jones movie.
It is. I accept it. No, you know, I've got the whole collection, and I've even got all the Scorpion King movies, although I've only seen the first one still. Yeah. But you know. That's neither here nor there.
No.
They tried to redo the Mummy again with, you know, Tom Cruise.
No, they didn't.
I never saw it.
It doesn't.
I didn't
see it. It's awful.
But. Oh, God. I saw... I don't remember what it was. The first time they tried to reboot that before they did Tom Cruise, there was another one. And I don't remember it. But, you know, they keep trying to redo this. And I'm like, you just need to tell a good story with semi-tragic figure at the center. Yeah. That's and just, you know, put time and care and effort into making it look good. Mm-hmm. It's like you could just watch this and be like, okay, this is a Universal classic, right?
I think you're going to be very happy with Candyman 2.
Good, good.
Yeah.
But they even modernize it in the fact where, you know, again, it's speaking on modern society. I know the original Universal movies didn't really speak on modern society, but if you're going to modernize it, make it modern, and you know. Like I said, you know, the modern audiences want, you know, some action, some gore, you know, give it to them. I think the way they meted out the violence was very effective.
I agree.
The scenes, you know, where shit gets real.
Yeah.
I mean, and not even like the gore, like the scene after when, you know, she's found in the apartment, you know, having cut off the head of the dog and, and Vanessa Williams is, you know, trying to kill her, rightfully so, because she thinks she killed her baby. You know, where does it go after that? It goes to her at the police station, you know, losing her shit and having to strip and, you know, do all the body checks and stuff like that. And it's brutal.
It's a brutal scene.
They got her best friend at the time to play the cop in that. And I'm like, good, because there's no way I would ever feel safe doing that scene myself. So I give you all the credit in the world for doing it, you know?
Yeah. And Madsen's great in this. I mean, yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. We've talked a little bit about, you know, Helen being kind of awful. But we're also as I kind of intimated at the beginning.
But in a likable way. I mean, she's.
I don't know if she's likable. I think she's sympathetic.
Yeah, there you go.
I think that's something that's come up a lot. I remember
because I think her, like, you know, like I called her a colonizer, or, you know, maybe she's a tourist. But I think that comes more from a place of naivety than, you know, actual malice. She seems to care more than a lot of the other people in the movie about, you know, the people who live there.
Yeah, to a degree. You know, I think that there's definitely a dismissal of them. There's definitely an idea that she.
But she at least sees them as people.
She even outright says in that same scene with Bernadette in the car, she's like, they are using this as an excuse for their problems.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, actually, the excuse for their problems is people like you. But Helen would probably thinks of herself as like an armchair liberal.
Yeah.
you know.
Oh, she's definitely like of the sort of that, you know, especially that day and age. But even now, you know, there's a lot of people who are like, you know, have this kind of, you know, white savior idea of themselves. Mm. It's like you could actually just listen to them and do what they tell you. Exactly. Is probably right.
That's know? Which is why I wanted to put, which is why I put that like kind of the disclaimer at the beginning of the movie. Where I'm like, we're all white guys talking about a movie that's talking about black people. We don't want to put ourselves in that you know white savior narrative.
And plus, nobody's right in this movie. I mean, nobody, you know,
not really.
There's not a. I hate to say there's not a good guy because it's, you know, it's not about good guys and bad guys, especially in a movie like this. It's about shades of gray. But, you know, nobody's coming at the problem completely clean, I don't think, except for well, what do you think about Vanessa Williams?
I think
by the end, I feel like she's kind of in on it.
Well, I think by the end of Vanessa Williams is catatonic by the end of it. Okay. When the bonfire, she's just staring off into space. She's traumatized.
That could just be bleed over from me recently reading the story too, because like in the story she knew, you know, they buried the kid, but it was actually like a dog in a coffin, and the kid was already dead and in Candyman's lair, and they, you know, disposed of the body by putting it in the bonfire,
right?
And the mother knew.
And I mean, I think it's pretty safe to say that Candyman had taken the baby in this
movie, right?
And put it in that bonfire. Which is why I was saying that Candyman was like, I have to kill the baby to punish the congregation.
Right.
They didn't believe in me, so now I have to take the life of an innocent, a true innocent. So that way you guys don't forget.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think
what I'm capable of. Don't forget. Because otherwise I have to hurt you. You know, there's a abusive father figure, I think, to Candyman, you know, where as long as you behave, I won't hurt you. But if you make me, I will do something terrible. You know, which is what I think makes him, which is why, I mean, that's the thing is I'm like, everybody kind of talks about this idea of, you know, about the murdered slave narrative and all that other stuff, which all makes him sympathetic. I don't think he's sympathetic at all in this movie. He's an evil
guy. But he's played with so much emotion and depth by Tony Todd that it's, you know, even if, you know, they gave him like, you know, a supervillain lair speech, you know, where he's like, wah ha ha ha, I'm gonna kill the whole community green.
Kind of do.
Know? Right. Yeah. But the way he's playing it, like it's like, you know, oh, I love this guy. You know,
he's a charismatic villain.
Right.
Yeah. He's still a villain. You know,
I'm not saying he's a good guy, but I think he is sympathetic. Because
I'm not sure. I would
maybe just not knowable enough to be relatable.
I think that he's but I mean, I think that he's a pretty much an evil dude. You know, I mean, he's not. And that's the thing is everybody's like, you know, he's a vengeful ghost trying to get revenge. I'm like, no, that's sympathetic.
Yeah, that's doesn't make sense. I don't see the sympathetic.
He's an evil creature,
right?
Taking.
I mean, like the thing that doesn't make sense is people saying he's a ghost trying to get revenge. I'm like, on who?
Yeah. And if he was, why, you know,
those people have been dead for 100 years themselves.
Yeah. And I was going to say, and if that were true, then they would be right that, you know, well, what's he doing in Cabrini Green when he should be on the other side of the bridge attacking people from Chicago? But I'm like, that's not what he's doing in this movie.
No.
He's, you know, and then, like I said, when we get to the sequels, we'll see a little more of that. But, in terms of Helen, I remember having this conversation when Haunting of Hill House came out, and a friend of mine was like, none of these characters are likable. And I went, they don't have to be likable to be good characters. They have to be relatable.
Yeah.
Or sympathetic to be good characters. And Mike Flanagan knows how to make a sympathetic character.
Goddamn right he does.
Sorry?
I said, goddamn right he does.
Yeah. And so we've got, but Candyman is another one of those movies where I'm like, Helen is not a likable character.
Right.
Although she's sympathetic. And the thing is like, also like, you know, there's some wonderful moments. Like she's at dinner and she, the snooty guy is mansplaining to her.
Right.
And she actually calls him out on it. And her Trevor, who, by the way, is the biggest scumbag on the history of the planet. You know, is like, and they don't even try.
Well, Xander Berkeley always plays scumbags just about. I mean, he's great at it.
One of my favorite things about this movie is they don't even try to make him seem like he might be an okay guy, like
from not until the end.
Go, Yeah, until the end. He has a little bit of a moment at the end of the movie where he's like sad. But
I liked that little turn that they did with him, because like, yeah, he's like, oh, I fucked up big time. You know,
maybe I really did love her. Yeah.
Right.
But
regret is not an excuse. Yeah. Guys. Yeah.
It's a little late at that point. Yeah. But my point is in that scene where he's like mansplaining and she calls him out, and Trevor gives her that look of like, honey, men are talking.
Right.
You know, don't do that. Don't call him out.
Yeah. Ooh. And you know, as a graduate student, you know,
yeah,
that, and a woman. It was implicit in the story and implied in the movie that she was a former student of Trevor's, you know, who married him. And now he's seeing another student on the side, and you know, she's used to people not taking her seriously, not listening to her. And part of that, you know, dating your professor and marrying your professor, you know, is going to feed into that, unfortunately, regardless of reason. But yeah, it's like the scene, the dinner, I really would have liked them to just have one more scene of actually like her literally burying that professor
yeah,
in some manner.
Although you're right, because he does say, well, clearly
I'm going to bury you.
She's like, I'm going to bury you. And he's like, well, clearly you've read the book I wrote on
this. Right.
And the thing is, though, he may have read the book. He doesn't really even wait for an affirmation on that. He just starts mansplaining Candyman to her.
Her expression of shock is really all that needs to be said about that. It's obvious that she did.
Yeah, she didn't
even know about it.
Yeah,
which is kind of weird, but you know, okay.
Well,
it's Trevor's friend, not hers.
Well, also, I think we get the implication that Candyman's a sort of a new thing here. Candyman was the new direction. They've been doing work on urban legends, and Candyman is the big break where they're like, oh, we have this sort of insider. Another great scene, one of my favorite scenes, is the cleaning ladies coming into the classroom, because it's so real. I work with those people. Those are the housekeepers at the hotels I've worked for.
I am those people.
Yeah. But I mean, down to the, like, first of all, it's kind of funny where she's like, oh, you want to talk to my friend? She's like, sure, I'd love to. And then she sticks her head out the door and like, hey, she wants to talk to you.
Yeah, and she's just mopping the same spot in the hallway.
Mopping the hallway, yeah. It's
what? What do you want? Yeah. And she kind of walks in like she's like, am I in trouble? You know, what's going on?
Exactly. Why does this lady want to talk to me? Am I in trouble? But even to the point where they're willing to be friendly and talk, but then they have that moment of we said too much and they get cagey.
Well, I don't know nothing about that.
I don't know nothing about that. That's how those conversations go. If they come up to you, if you ask them to come and talk to you, it will be friendly until they get to a certain point and be like, wait a minute, I don't trust.
It's guarded. Yeah, because if I don't know, a guest says something, you know, like this, you know, one of the cleaning people is, you know, being impolite or too forward or whatever, like, you know, that they get in trouble for that. The same thing with if, you know, a teacher or a professor or even, you know, a graduate student's like, hey, this, you know, cleaning lady was kind of rude to me. Like,
yeah,
they're going to believe her. They're not going to believe you, you know?
Exactly. And that's what I mean is it's such a great scene because I'm like, this is actually kind of how this, you know, quote, you know, this is how the two haves meet, you know, the haves and the haves nots, where there's a moment of we're kind of on the same page, but then the poor cleaning ladies are like, we're not the same.
Yeah.
You know,
and it's just like the knowledge, you know, of that Bernard Rose brought to it of, you know, how things work in the real world is like, you know, pretty amazing. Because he was, you know, another British guy who, you know, I'm not familiar with his other work. He did a lot of like music videos and stuff like that. And like, but you know, this is really a team lift when they went to write this, because they took, you know, the basis of the story and they transported the whole thing to, you know, modern American society. It was modern in the book too, but it was, you know, British projects are different.
Oh, he made Paper House. That's a pretty good movie.
I have not seen it, no.
All right.
But just like, it's just surprising because this is, you know, very, if you told me that somebody grew up in, you know, somebody who grew up in Chicago wrote this, I'd be like, that makes sense. If you said a British guy wrote this, I'd be like, really? You know?
Yeah, that's right. He's from England. Totally. It's just such a great movie about that really does want to talk about the hazards, the have-nots, the relationship that happens, that separation is both physical and figurative. Right.
And even the fact that it just melds so well into, you know, I'm obviously a huge fan of, like, you know, modern mythology and urban folklore.
Yeah.
I think we all are if we're horror fanatics.
More than likely, yeah.
Yeah. But they just meld it so well because, you know, there's a basis for these modern folklores where it's always the outsider. It's always, you know, an escaped lunatic. I'm sorry to use the term, but that's what they, you know, Yeah,
that's the truth.
It's always been, you know, somebody who's deformed, somebody who's, you know, mentally disabled, inbred. There's a lot of, you know, even in Ohio, there's a lot of, like, urban legends about, like, inbred families that, you know, live in the woods and, you know, they have melon heads or whatever. And to know to blend that with, you know, how society works in you know, a stratified way is just a stroke of brilliance that I think just elevates this to not just being another horror movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then on top of that, you got this amazing casting and, you know, amazing production designs and, you know,
yeah,
shots that they had to make, you know, new rigs for helicopters to shoot. I mean,
there's some wonderful overhead photography in this movie.
Yeah.
And
it's only like a $5 million budget or something.
It's not a huge budget movie. Mm-hmm. And as we kind of talked about, like, you know, Virginia Madsen was probably the only person anybody had really heard of,
right,
in this movie, and she was not a big star at the time.
No,
I don't know if she ever really was. I think
she was popular for Dune and one other movie I can't remember the name of at this point, but she's, you know, this, like, they kind of deglamified her. You know, they let her cut her hair. They used minimal makeup on her. They tried to make her an every girl. But I mean, if you look at her, she looks like a Marilyn Monroe. I mean,
she does.
In a lot of ways. But yeah, they let her, you know, she doesn't look Hollywood, I guess what I'm saying. Like, she looks like a regular person you'd see.
Yeah.
To a point.
By then she had done...
There's one other really popular one I can't remember the name of.
Oh, she was in Highlander 2, the one you're thinking of. But
that's one of the things I would have seen her in at the time.
Yeah. And she had been in Zombie High by that point, I think, too. But she did some stuff, but she wasn't, wasn't a household name, is my guy, guess, point.
And Tony Todd was, you know, like, well, he's in 1990, but, you know, he's in a lot of Star Trek. He was a Shakespearean actor, you know, played an Othello, and he's just got that voice, and the way they even, you know, modulate the voice for this is just makes it even better.
I remember getting to use my horror knowledge I was watching this with Lori, and she asked about the bees. It's like, right, how did they do that? I'm like, literally a bee wrangler. Like,
yeah. Oh,
thank you. And I'm like, apparently Tony Todd fucking loved it.
Right. But
the guy had no problem with it. He was just like, I'm just okay, cover me in bees, I guess. And Lori was like, no, thank you. And I was like, well, also at the same time, they were frozen.
Yeah.
So they were sluggish and, you know, they weren't stinging, but still.
And they said, like, Bernard Rose or somebody, like, you know, paid him $1,000 for every bee that we would, you know, sting him or whatever. Yeah. And Virginia Madsen apparently was, like, crazy allergic to bees.
Yeah.
So they had to have, like, a paramedic on set when she had her bee scenes. And I was like, oh, that sucks.
Yeah, it really sucks. But yeah, I've never been stung by a bee. I don't know if I actually am allergic, but I might be. But
I'm stung by wasps, but
I don't think I would be able to do that.
No.
You know, it's similar to, like, what was it? In Hellraiser with the maggots. Mm-hmm.
Right.
I think of her name now. Christy Cotton. What's her fucking name? It's after midnight here in Missouri,
folks. Right, it's after midnight. Yeah. It's 1 in the morning here.
But I don't know. Anyway, the actress.
Yeah, I was trying to Ashley think of it. Like, there
Ashley
you go.
Ashley Lawrence. She was.
My brain was throwing up Heather Langenkamp, but I'm like, that's not right.
It's not the right one. Yeah.
No.
Ashley Lawrence was another person, I guess, was just fearless and just, like, stuck her hands into a maggot pile of maggots. Right. And I was like, I don't think I could do that. Even though I'm not really phobic about any of these things, I still don't think I could do it.
Well, there's just a natural aversion to creepy crawlies and, you know, humans. I mean,
But yeah, Tony Todd, I mean, Tony Todd and Drew Madsen, Troopers, I guess. But
yeah, they had the scene where he had him all in his jacket and like,
yeah, in his mouth.
Well, I guess the jacket was even more problematic because, like, they don't, bees don't like to be contained. And he was saying, you know, like, oh, if I, when I, you know, as soon as I opened my jacket, the bees were, you know, fucking pissed.
Yeah.
Looking to.
Yeah. But yeah, the funniest part for me on this watch through with Lori was when she gets out of the mental hospital and she goes to Trevor's apartment and she's with the, we finds him with the other woman. And Lori and I were both sitting there in silence and I just kind of said, you know, you can kill him, right?
Right. You're already on the hook for like,
you're already on the hook for a murder. And Lori said, well, what are they going to do?
Well, they gonna do two or three murders.
Yeah. But I was like, what are you going to do? Fry you twice?
You know, because you know she's going to get the charge for the psychiatrist as well. I mean,
somehow, yeah. Even though
we somehow security, no, she was the only one in the room.
Yeah, but the security camera picks up that he's literally killed by nobody.
Yeah, I mean, they're still going to.
But yeah, you know, it's the same thing as like we were talking about with Nightmare 3 about like the rational world versus that. Right. Even when presented with evidence of something supernatural happening, they're still going to be like, no, that's not what happened.
Right? Because how do you prove a ghost in the court of law? Prove a ghost?
Yeah.
And that's the other point where I thought they kind of overstepped a little bit. I mentioned, you know, the murals that showed, you know, her in a historical setting and him in a historical setting, because I would have liked a little more, you know, them being a little less specific about him actually being, you know, this person at one point. But this is the other point where I'm like, they shouldn't have had the security camera footage. Like, that's just showing us that one of these things happened in the real world, you know?
If
they would have cut that out, it still could have been, you know, I could make a solid case for like everything being done by Helen in an altered state.
Yeah, that's totally exactly right. The only thing that does that dismisses that possible read is the security camera footage.
Right.
Otherwise, everything could have been, Helen got confused and
everything is obviously intended to read like that, where, you know, you could read it either way, but until this point, like, they're like, because it's the third act, we need to show that this is real, I guess.
I think you're right. I don't think we needed it. I think we still would have bought it as real.
I think the only thing
would have happened would you have had some people wanting to make that case,
right?
And it would have been just as valid
as
any other case,
because you know, other than that, all we see is like, you know, even when he, you know, unstraps her after killing him.
Yeah.
It's just her seeing him unstrap her after killing him.
Yeah.
You know, she's obviously got, you know, a history of blackouts at this point.
At this point. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you could have been other than that security damage. Yeah, I think you might be right. I think that might be one of the film's few missteps. Right. I do think if I were going to make an honest criticism, I do think the first act drags a little. Right. I think getting a little bit of action in there a little bit sooner might have worked. But otherwise, I do think the movie I think is a great film.
Right. I don't think it's padded. I don't think the first act is padded, but it needs to set up a lot of stuff. And I could see a couple of different ways they could have done a part of it in, you know, better ways. But
yeah, I just think it's just a little slow.
Yeah.
You know, I think that if we had put a dream sequence in or make that opening sequence a little bit bloodier. I don't know. You know, it could have, I don't know.
Yeah. Actually showing Ted Raimi getting gunned, it would have been fun, but,
and Ted would have been game for it. Ted
loved
that show. But that's also, I love watching that. I've forgotten all about it. I watched it this time. I was like, oh shit, that's right. Ted Raimi is the bad boy.
Somehow. I love Ted Raimi, but he is the dorkiest looking motherfucker since me, you know.
Yeah, he's so dorky looking, and I'm like, yeah, he's the bad boy, all right. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's supposed to be showing us a little bit of the story's manufactured.
Yeah, it's supposed to read like an Archie comic almost.
He's
wearing the Letterman jacket and everything.
He was wearing a leather jacket.
Right, that's like, yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah. He's just wearing the biker jacket. Yeah.
Right. Well, yeah, that's right, because he's the bad boy biker. It was her boyfriend. It was like the football star. Whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, it's a wonderful film. I think it's a really fantastic piece. Oddly enough, I don't think The Forbidden is one of Clive Barker's most famous stories. And so it's interesting that this movie is based on The Forbidden, because I don't think that one's all that well known.
So Books of Blood 5. And up until recently, I hadn't read past like 3 or 4 in the Books of Blood. There's six of them total.
I get them all confused. I've read
them. Especially since a lot of them, you know, this one was, I think, re-released as like, you know, a book around the time of the movie. I know, like, you know, Nightbreed and, you know, Hellraiser and stuff like that was released on its own, you know, after the films. But I seem to think that this one was as well.
Well, this one was the Forbidden was a short story versus Cabal or Hellbound Heart.
No, it was like a novella. I mean, it's I was listening to the audiobook at work this week, and it was like, it's like almost 2 hours long. I mean, it's not that short. Not long enough to be a novel, but especially to somebody like me who reads, you know, way too much, too long Stephen King shit. But
Let's see. It is listed as a short story.
Long as short story.
Yeah. Trying to find a cage count. But anyway, yeah, it's not one of his most famous stories.
No.
But yeah, it's sorry, I'm using Google. Well, I shouldn't be doing that. But
doesn't matter. I certainly hadn't heard of this, you know, the short story before I watched the movie, and I think a lot of people haven't either. Than people who, you know, read all the Books of Blood 100 times back in the day when they came out.
Yeah. But I mean, at the same time, what is Clive Barker's most famous work? I mean, I feel like a lot of people know Clive and read his work. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's any stories of his that really broke out the way Stephen King's did.
He's done a couple of fantasy books that are pretty popular.
Sure.
Like The Thief of Always. Yeah, and, I love it. I always want to say Arabica, but that's not it. There was like a fantasy series he did.
Aberrant.
There you go, Aberrant.
Which I read and they were okay. But Thief of Always I love. And I've always been more of a fan of Clive's short story work more than his novel.
Same.
But even though I do like some of his novels, but
The Great and Secret Show was pretty great.
Yeah, somewhat. Mostly. Yeah.
It was a little long, but it was.
I think by the end, it starts to fall apart. But, because I've always had the theory that Clive, with his novels, Clive didn't exactly know where he was going.
That's kind of Clive's career. I mean, he started off, you know, being a playwright and, you know, wanted to put out an underground plays and then became an author and a filmmaker and a 16-pack-a-day smoker. And that was a joke in his voice. Sorry, guys. Yeah. That man gargles razor blades for fun, apparently.
Well, he's been sick for a long time. I think he was a heavy smoker, and I think he had some emphysema problems, I think.
Could be. I don't know.
Clive Barker is a great guy. I've always preferred him to Stephen King. Even though it's more like his short story work is awesome.
Yeah.
His novels were hit or miss. We haven't really touched Hellraiser yet, but
matter of time.
But that Hellraiser book he wrote later was sucked. But
it had Harry DeMore. How can you go wrong? Oh, you can go wrong with Harry DeMore, but yeah. It was okay.
But Clive's great, and this movie's great, and I think we're probably wrapping up on time. What do you you have any last thoughts on Candyman?
If you haven't seen it, you know, really check it out with an open mind, because I think there's a lot there that people don't think about when they think of Candyman. They just think of, like you said, you know, just the saying his name in front of the mirror 5 times, and people might know his hook for a hand or his voice, but there's a lot. There's a lot going on here that's not just, you know, slasher movie stuff.
Yeah, a lot of metafictional rumination going on in this movie.
Even I was, you know, just for shits and giggles before we went out, I was watching the Siskel and Ebert review of the movie, and they didn't hate it, which I was kind of surprised about. They both seemed to agree that it got too gory, but that's, you know, kind of you expect that from them.
And it's
Siskel was more negative than Ebert was, but they both seemed to kind of like it, at least in concept.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a really great movie with a lot going on in it that maybe isn't there apparent, that isn't super apparent. Right. And hopefully we haven't pissed anybody off.
If we did, we're sorry. We're just trying to do it the best we can.
We just wanted to talk about Candyman. Right. But yeah, I was always a little bit reluctant to touch Candyman a little bit for a while because I was always like, are we going to?
Well, I mean, we could talk about the history of racism in America as white people. We just can't speak for anyone but us white people.
And we're usually the villain. So
yeah, right.
Yeah. But yeah, so it's but yeah, there's a lot going on in this movie. Stop saying the new one is woke. Yeah, they were always woke. Horror was always woke. Also,
art has always been woke.
Pretty much. Also, stop saying Jordan Peele made the new Candyman movie. He did not. Neither did Costa's movie.
I swear I didn't notice anybody saying that until you pointed it out to me. Now that's all I fucking see.
Yeah.
Yeah. So thanks for that.
Yeah, the media blitz kept and a lot of websites kept doing, you know, film critics being like Jordan Peele's new movie, and everybody's like, you're erasing a black woman.
Yeah.
You know.
But even in general, I feel it's rude because I mean, you know, you've gone on before in the past about, you know, stuff like Guillermo del Toro getting, you know, credit for everything he produces.
Yeah.
And I'm a huge Del Toro fan, but I agree that it's like, come on. Somebody else did make this, you know.
Somebody else made that movie, yeah. And I've always had a pet peeve about that in general.
Right, it's just rude. It's just
I remember it happened with Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark too, where it was Guillermo del Toro. Mm-hmm. It was like Andre Overdahl made that movie.
Producers can have a creative, you know, voice in projects. This is one of them. Can't remember the other producer, but I mean, obviously Clive Barker worked on this as well.
Yeah.
And they all seem to be pretty hands-on with it. It's not inaccurate to say that they had a part in these movies, but really you need to credit the producer and the writer first.
Yeah.
And foremost.
Yeah. That's the thing. Yeah. So you need DaCosta, say her name, as they say now on the internet. But yeah, so I guess that pretty much does it here for Candyman this week. Yep. We're going to probably plug away on the other two in the next coming weeks, for better or worse. I know you haven't seen them, but I remember the second movie being pretty decent. The third one, maybe not so much.
That seems to be the consensus I ran into. I should say real quick that the reason I didn't see the other ones is because I felt like this was the whole story.
I agree.
In the first one. And I'm like, do I need to? You know?
Yeah. Well, that's why I kind of wanted to be like, let's talk about this movie without the sequels, because this movie, you know, it's easy to forget, even with any of these franchises, that they weren't meant to be franchises. They were created as an individual film and then sequeled.
Yeah. And, you know, I accept that sequelization, you know, franchisation and, you know, remakes are going to happen. But sometimes I'm just like, you know, I don't want to diminish the first one or possibly diminish the first one by, you know, seeing these other ones that may be lesser.
Yeah. If memory serves, to Candyman 2, Farewell of the Flesh, mostly just basically more creates a canon in a way that the original movie doesn't. And, which is, you know, franchise 101.
Yeah.
You know, if you got to make a sequel, then you got a background.
I mean, I'm sure I've watched far worse stuff than Candyman 2 or 3 with just to see Tony Todd. So
very true. Very true.
And, you know, the reason I wanted to go and do this is because I'm really jazzed to see, you know, the new Candyman by, who was that? Jordan Peele? Was that Keaton?
Jordan Peele. Yeah. It's about black people. It must have been made by Jordan Peele.
Right.
We'll be doing that. And hopefully we'll maybe have some guests on this week, this month sometime. We'll see. Schedules are weird, but for now we'll be plugging away at these Candyman film, Candyman movies, and we'll see you on down the road. So any last thoughts, Sam?
No, I think we covered it.
Okay. Then, as forever, we want to remind you to keep it positive, keep it constructive, love yourself, love your fellow horror fans. Appreciate your filmmakers
And credit them properly.
Yep. Credit them properly for the work that they did. And we'll see you on down the road. So, so thank you very much. Good night. And namaste.